Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Chris Hutton. Our first news story for today is a looming motion of no confidence that's going to be called against Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi. This has been caused by the called by the DA, and the DA's Gauteng leader, Solly Msimanga, has been saying that this is in direct response to the public protectors' finding against Panyaza Lesufi with regards to the so-called the crime prevention wardens initiative, which was Panyaza Lesufi's sort of flagship project. The public protector found that this program basically wasn't correctly constituted, and therefore it had to be repurposed into essentially a traffic warden program. Solly Msimanga said that we warned that the recruits of the Ama Panyaza initiative were not adequately trained, insufficiently resourced, and did not meet the legal criteria to serve as peace officers. Premier Lesufi stubbornly chose to ignore these warnings, pressing ahead with a costly program that has now collapsed under its own weight. The DA will table a motion of no confidence against Premier Lesufi for his reckless and irresponsible implementation of the failed Ama Panyaza project. The time for lies, deception, and exploiting the plight of thousands of desperate job seekers in Gauteng must come to an end. This is the end of the road for Lesufi. The public protector report is an indictment that he is not fit to govern Gauteng. Well, is it really the end of the road for Panyaza Lesufi? Panyaza Lesufi does not hold a majority in the Gauteng legislature. The ANC only was able to elect Lesufi with support from the DA. There was initially an understanding that the DA would form a coalition government with Panyaza Lesufi, but the DA ultimately rejected the terms that were offered because they felt that they were not being offered enough positions in the Gauteng provincial government. So Lesufi has continued to govern through a minority government, relying mostly on the EFF and MK and whatever parties will support him on any particular issue to keep his government afloat. So in order for this to pass, it's going to need MK or the EFF to back it. The DA and even some of the smaller parties backing this motion of no confidence won't be enough. So where do MK and the EFFs lie? Well, it doesn't look like they're going to support it. It's possible that MK might. That is a little bit more unclear to me. The EFF has been sort of being a little bit coy about what position it was exactly going to take. Publicly, it was saying that it would not support the motion against Panyaza Lesufi by the DA unless the DA apologized to its leadership for disparaging it in public, which seems like a nonsense reason. According to some reporting, though, from various news outlets, including The Citizen, the EFF was instead behind the scenes negotiating for the appointment of Johannesburg City Manager Floyd Brink to be the chief manager, the city manager of Johannesburg. The EFF said that when the ANC held up the reappointing of Floyd Brink as the city manager in Joburg, that they immediately began to consider supporting the motion of no confidence against Lesufi. Now today, there is news that Floyd Brink was indeed appointed as the city manager of Joburg, despite the fact he's been removed twice by a court from that position and has an incredibly poor record of service delivery as the chief official in Johannesburg. So Chris, it really seems here like in order to protect his premiership, Lesufi has managed to get the Joburg ANC to throw the city of Joburg under the bus so that he can hang on for a few months more. What do you make of this?
I don't underestimate Premier Lesufi's ability to wheel and deal, to surprise with positions given up or promised in exchange for continued stability in his case, in his position, and those who he favors in key positions. I mean, we saw after last year's national elections and the national and provincial elections and the results thereof, I mean, the probability, the weight was towards, given that at a national level, you had a GNU and a coalition between the DA and the ANC, that things would follow in the provinces as well. And Gauteng, bucked that trend. So Premier Lesufi has shown in the past, I think he's very unwilling to go along with many things that national leadership sort of requires of him. And in this particular instance, if we see in any way national ANC leadership saying, look, maybe there is something to this motion of no confidence. Maybe there are some questions about some of the policies you've implemented in Gauteng here, Premier. Let's figure out how we deal with this. I think it's going to push him more into that sort of corner, and he will be even more tempted to make these kinds of deals going forward to the ultimate cost of the citizens of Gauteng and of governments in the province as well, because there would probably then be there would be more parties involved and there would be more unstable. The DA obviously won't be involved in any of them should he, I think, remain premier of Gauteng, at least for the time being. I guess the balance of forces in the province within the ANC in Gauteng is more towards in his favor and arguably also towards Vice President Paul Mashatile. They would probably be in the same sort of camp, sort of aligned in that particular route. As to the EFF, I mean, their decline in last year's elections and now losing so much in terms of organizational capacity, not least of which Floyd Jivambu, and then trying to stabilize and grow again, trying to, you know, what do they offer voters that has been sort of overtaken in terms of promise and spectacle by the MK party. For the EFF's future is, I think, going to continue to be dominated by being the sort of kingmaker in various coalitions around the country and probably in national government as well. So what they can then extract in terms of positions, in terms of promises, but also then continue in some ways their access to government resources in terms of feeding their own patronage networks, all that kind of thing. So unfortunately, you know, the woes for Gauteng, for metros in the province, I don't think are at an end anytime soon, because we're not going to have the kind of parties putting forward priorities in terms of governance, service delivery, et cetera, et cetera. It's more about political survival, wheeling and dealing, and you know, the issues of when you open your tap and water runs out, when you flip a light switch and the light comes on, those aren't of highest priority, I think, for the time being.
Yeah, you know, I think for Lesufi, he's kind of desperately trying to hold on to the premiership, because being in the opposition benches, firstly, has never been great for the ANC. They always have, whenever that's happened, they've always had a really difficult time sort of recovering after it. And he's, I think, staking his entire political fortunes on the idea that a anti-DA faction in the ANC is going to win the next elective leadership conference, and that you know, suddenly MK and the EFF will come on board to his government in Gauteng, and then that will restore him, and then he can position himself to either lead the country or lead Gauteng into the future or whatever. If he's in opposition, he doesn't have that sort of powerful patronage position and powerful platform to you know, throw his weight around inside the ANC. He'll look kind of weak and his influence will diminish. So for his long-term political prospects, he needs to hold on to Gauteng, I think, at all costs. And so if that means that you have to give the EFF what it wants in Joburg, well, that's a sacrifice he's willing to make. But of course, you know, if you wanted to actually turn Joburg around in time for the next local government election, you probably have to appoint a person who with a better track record than Floyd Brink as a city manager in Joburg. And that's something that the ANC has once again shown that it's not willing to do. In fact, that's probably their only hope if they want to retain proper control of the city, or, you know, or keep the DA at bay in Joburg. Now, that doesn't mean the DA is going to win Joburg, but it certainly puts the ANC in a position to not be the biggest party anymore, which I think is, on current trends, the most likely scenario. Do you agree with what I've said out there? Do you have anything to add?
No, I think I'd largely go along with that. I mean, given our politics, you know, has become so fractured, we might next year see a bit of a consolidation, right, of some of these smaller parties. We've already seen hints of that, you know, at least in rhetoric. We'll see how parties campaign on the ballot, as it were. But some of the smaller parties might then sort of coalesce together. That also then, in turn, for someone like Lesufi and for the ANC in Gauteng, where does that leave you? If you're guaranteed that you're going to continue declining and you lose votes, you lose support, does that support go to parties like the EFF or MK? Does it go to other smaller parties? Does it go to the DA? My point is, does it go to blocs or to parties that you could then work with, that you're sort of putting your chips in that particular on the table for those parties like the EFF, and you say, look, we're going to decline, but at least we can secure some kind of continued high-level positions, access to resources, et cetera, et cetera, where it's not about national maneuvering. We don't really, you know, care about the GNU even. We don't have those aspirations. It really comes down to survival. I think more and more the pressure bearing down on the ANC is going to result in this kind of thing. And this is the more, as it were, benign outcome of the declining support of the ANC and the pressure on its patronage networks. The most destructive outcome are the things like construction mafias, water mafias, unrest, killing of councillors, that sort of violence. So this kind of thing, while, you know, I don't wish this upon Gauteng and upon Johannesburg to continue to have this administration, it could be the least bad of the options for the time being, as we're in this moment of serious turbulence as the ANC continues to decline in the broader South African politics.
Okay, let's move on to our next story. And we're going to be talking a little bit about Eskom here. And I will say again, as I've said before, that I've been surprised by how we managed to get out of load shedding. I was very skeptical when we were at the worst point of load shedding that the recovery would be anytime soon. But through a combination of individuals taking themselves off grid and, you know, finding alternatives to the power grid, and of course Eskom improving its operational performance, South Africa has been blessedly mostly free from load shedding for a while now. And Eskom has turned a profit for the first time in a long time. But we're not out of the woods yet, and this is a very important point to make. The bigger problems with Eskom still remain, and this is highlighted in a report that came out, I think it was last week, from the ratings agency Moody's, who highlighted that the municipal debt to Eskom, for example, is a really big part of the sort of looming next problem with Eskom. Municipal debt to Eskom has escalated to more than 100 billion rand, and Moody says that the utility will not be off the government's books by 2028. It will almost certainly still be draining the fiscus in some way. According to the ratings agency, despite some improvements, the National Treasury and Eskom have failed to address the culture of non-payment by municipalities, and that persistently poor operational performance, despite recent improvements since the past financial year, and electricity tariffs that do not adequately cover the company's operating and capital expenditure, mean that getting rid of this debt problem is not going to happen anytime soon. Something like 80% of Eskom's current debt is guaranteed by the government. So Eskom's debt problems are very much our debt problems. And there are projections by Eskom that municipal debt will escalate to 135 billion rand by next financial year and to 329 billion rand by 2030. Now, that's a big lot of money. Chris, you know, how do we get out of this? What's the plan here?
I don't, you know, the plan is to maintain the monopoly for the time being, because if you really change legislation and policy to allow for municipalities to generate and distribute electricity and also for private producers, then you end, in law, you end Eskom's monopoly, where at this point in time, yes, you can install your solar panels and you can, you know, do all of that sort of stuff, but you're still tied into the grid. You can't distribute, you can't sell. There's no revenue sort of involved. So that doesn't really present that challenge to Eskom. So to Eskom and to its principal, the government, and arguably the executive, so the president, given that it's still an ANC president, there's no ideological, you know, question that Eskom needs to remain in place. It needs to, the ANC needs to control that lever of the economy of the state to provide electricity to the economy and to society. And if that results in the wrong kind of economic outcomes, then I guess it's part of the pain to get us to the national democratic revolution. So for as long as those things remain in place, you'll continue to see these cycles for Eskom. To give credit to the current board, you know, things have been better the last 12 months. They've focused on power station maintenance, on the coal fleet. They haven't gone in on renewable energy. They've realized, look, in South Africa's benefit to use the coal that it still has a lot of, and to use that for Eskom. But it's not subject to market forces. It's not subject to supply and demand. It's not subject to the sort of rigors of what a normal business would be, where if you make the wrong financial decisions, the wrong infrastructure, capex decisions, the wrong salary calculations and commitments, you've got the government to bail you out, whether that's the government directly, whether it's municipalities, whether it's taxpayers, et cetera, et cetera. It's not on the line as a private business would be for its wrong business decisions and investments. I guess something I want to tie in here and just mention before I forget is for Eskom, the fact that it's managed to keep the lights on better than in 2023 when we had record high load shedding, it is giving some in Eskom and in the ANC and in government, it's giving them a reason to say, but why do we need to unbundle Eskom anymore? Why do we need any changes to legislation? Because see, we can do this. We can keep the lights on. Why do we need private sector competition and participation? And this is really a sort of reminder and a call to especially the businesses that have been involved in helping Eskom to continue to pressure for the right kinds of policy changes that we need to have a really competitive electricity market, because we at this point in time we're not going to get it. And part of the reason is Eskom and government will say, we can do this, why should we need to get rid of our monopoly?
All right. I just want to quickly take a break here to talk about the 46th Hoernle Memorial Lecture, which is going to be hosted by the Institute of Race Relations. And it's featuring a talk by Professor Hussein Solomon from the University of the Free State. The title of the talk is Embracing Machiavelli to Achieve a Liberal Future. It's going to be held on the 6th of November, which is a Thursday, at 5:30 in the evening at 21 Rockridge Road, Parktown in Johannesburg. There will be snacks and finger food available. There will be a link to where you can get a ticket down below. There are limited tickets available. It's 120 Rand per person. If you're interested in the kind of stuff we talk about here, if you're interested about solutions for South Africa going into the future, please come along. I think you will find it very interesting if you are a fan of the show. Okay. Just on your last point there, Chris, complacency is, I think, a really big part of the problem here, which is that the only thing that has sort of made any positive development in government's policy since basically Zuma took over is crisis. That's the only time the ANC has been forced to sort of grapple with reality. And just as you say, I think it's extremely likely that with all the ideological and patronage and corruption forces pushing, to keep the status quo, if you take the break off on the reforms, on pressing for the reforms, because, we don't have load shedding right now, you may very well find yourself with load shedding in the not too distant future. We're in this horrible conundrum where if the economy actually does start growing, we may find ourselves bumping up against the edges of our actual electricity capacity anyway. And in fact, in some ways, we've been given more breathing room to build up the infrastructure, get Medupi and Kusile, the big coal power plants online, because the economy's been growing so slowly, so we haven't seen this rocketing demand. Any final thoughts?
No, I think that is a very good point. I mean, we've got in the ANC's latest 10-point economic plan, talk about rebuilding our chrome industries and mining and all that sort of thing. My high level, very thought through retort is, why do they need to be rebuilt? What happened to those industries? Why are they in a very weak, almost non-existent state? What did you as the ANC do in terms of policies that caused this over the last 15 to 20 years? But, more seriously, if we want to get to a kind of level of industrialization and manufacturing value add, that sector, construction, manufacturing, they need reliable, cheap electricity supply from competing power sources and power companies. That kind of thing, maybe by force of reality, will eventually be achieved. But for now, you see the ANC sticking to the sort of areas of comfort. It does the same in its foreign policy. It doesn't want difficult discussions. It wants to remain in the areas where it's comfortable, it can retain influence and power.
No, 100%. Okay, let's talk about our last story. This is just an interesting piece I read in the Daily Maverick about gun crime in South Africa, particularly with relating to gangs. This is a piece describing recent gang shootings in Westbury, which is a suburb of Johannesburg. I know some people from that area, and so I've heard some of the stories and seen videos of just how awful the violence is in this part of Joburg. There have been recent shootings between rival gangs where a number of kids, two teenagers were shot dead recently and five others wounded. The police haven't yet arrested anyone, at least at the time of the writing of this article. And despite many promises that things are going to be improved and that the police are going to step things up, local residents are pretty skeptical, according to the reporting here, and I don't blame them. They interviewed people from kind of involved with these gangs for this article. One guy who's got under the pseudonym Peter, although he apparently did give his real name, but the journalists didn't want to actually print it out in because despite his assurances that he didn't mind his real name being public, they thought that it'd probably be better not to. There's two big gangs in Westbury, the Verados and the Fast Guns, and they routinely are killing each other. It started over conflict over drugs, but now it's just turned into essentially a cycle of revenge killing because everyone has basically had a friend or relative in the gang killed by the other gang, and so they just constantly are taking revenge on each other. This hitman for the gang they talked to said that he killed his first person on his 21st birthday, and since then he's killed another five people. He says every murder he's committed was for revenge, not money. Quote, "It's just for blood, and my job is to shoot." He said that he doesn't really care if anyone sees his face or hears of his deeds. He says, "The Almighty looks after me. That's how I survive." The journalists couldn't verify these claims exactly, but other people in the community said that it was true. This hitman also claimed that the murders he committed were carried out with guns sold to him by the police. That when the police confiscated guns from gang members, they often ended up selling it back to them. There's some other details here. Recently, or a couple years ago, Becky Kele visited the area after a kid was shot dead in the heart and promised that everything would be cleaned up. He said to the police's top brass in a public speech, "Sanitize this place, strip it, and sanitize it." And there were increased police patrols for a little bit, but very quickly they were reallocated somewhere else and things returned to normal and the violence has continued apace. There's this wonderful detail where, as the journalist is walking around, a group of the now disbanded Amapanyaza crime prevention wardens are walking around, and one of the residents chuckles, "Yeah, I don't know what they're supposed to do. They don't even have guns." which is kind of suggests how rough things are there. But for me, the most interesting part of this whole story was the journalist talked to two drug dealers. These are guys who were a former welder and a former taxi driver who now sell mandrax and crystal meth to people who live in Westbury. And the one said, "All I want to do is make money. I would leave this if I could find a job. If there were jobs, it would sort out this drug problem." So according to drug dealers, the way to sort out the drug problem in South Africa is more employment. Now, I think it's more complicated than that, but it's, once again, I think, Chris, just a reminder of how important economic growth and job creation really is to almost every problem we have in South Africa. What's your take from all of this?
Yes, indeed. That feedback is consistent with our polling for many years now. When you ask South Africans, what are the top two priorities they want government to focus on? Number one is unemployment and jobs. I mean, year after year, despite the rhetoric from politicians about land reform and racism and inequality, it's the very basic thing of unemployment and jobs. I guess the one thing I want to highlight from what you mentioned there and the sort of broader story is the issue of criminals getting access to firearms via the police. That's something that I think is very much underestimated in the South African criminal story, high crime rate story, where you can have all the regulation, all of that sort of thing that you might want. If the police, don't do the right thing, then at the end of the day, it's only unarmed citizens, those who would want to be armed, whose life is made more difficult because maybe the legislation, the regulations are too onerous and too strict. But also number two, it's just easier for criminals to get their access, to get their hands on firearms.
Yeah, I mean, if you find that you want to hand in your gun to the police, or you can't afford to keep it anymore, and you decide that you're going to hand it into the police, how do you know that it's not going to be sold on to gangs? This has happened before in South Africa, and a lot of it is uninvestigated because the people who might be investigating it are also the people who might be doing it. I think it is a really serious issue that is part of the whole collapse in faith in the police. And, you know, gangs are a complicated thing. They form for a whole bunch of reasons. They kind of are almost like a sort of parallel state institution that sort of hides within a society. They you know, often end up carrying out functions of government like law and order and justice, you know, once the state authority has collapsed, and they often persist even if a state authority returns. So they're a difficult thing to unseat. But police have certainly left a huge space for them. And there are many people who accuse the police of often turning a blind eye towards these gangs, probably because they are being bribed. And this isn't just a Gauteng problem. This is also a common problem across the Western Cape, where the majority of gang killings take place. Any final thoughts on this one, Chris?
I guess, you know, it shouldn't have to take this kind of very unfortunate and sad, you know, reporting this story to remind, you know, the policymakers once again of the importance of getting the right kind of policies in place in the sort of crime policing sphere in South Africa. If you talk about giving, you know, real power back to communities, if you talk about giving metros, provinces the capacity to deal with the crime issues in their respective jurisdictions, you're going to have to start to move on devolution of policing powers and that sort of thing. And it's not to present then the challenge to central government, but it's to make sure that within their limited resources, those metros, those provinces can then take the right decisions that they need to. You see someone like Lieutenant General Nkonazi, who's talked tough on crime and then acted tough on crime in KwaZulu-Natal, and his, you know, heightened popular support. You can see how, you know, if other provinces could follow suit, maybe without waiting for the government in all instances, the national government, you know, that could really start to get somewhere to dealing with the high level of crime that unfortunately continues to afflict all South Africans.
Right, but devolution done correctly. I mean, and this is one of the tragedies, I think, of the crime prevention wardens scheme that Lesufi set up. You know, this is in theory, there's some good ideas behind this, but then the whole thing was done badly, and then it turns out that the public protector ends up disbanding it. So once again, if you want to fix South Africa, you need to do two difficult but simple things. One is grow the economy, and the other is clean up the police. If you do those two things, everything else will start to get better. And I think that's the thing that all of our politicians need to keep in their minds at all times. And all of our voters need to keep in their minds at all times. When you're voting, if the parties aren't achieving those two things, then you should really consider who you're voting for. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. We will, of course, be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.